Welcome to Mission Critical, a podcast about the big picture, the purpose, and the values that drive today's most game-changing companies, entrepreneurs, and leaders. I'm your host, Lance Chung, Editor-in-Chief of Glory Media, and I'll be introducing you to a group of brilliant minds who are making an impact on the world and forging the path ahead. While they may all be very different from each other, the question remains the same. What's your mission? Omar, I'm so happy to be chatting with you today. How's it going?
It's great. We've been talking for what seems like years. It's nice that we finally get together.
It's so crazy because I feel like I've just like known you personally for like years, but like this is literally just our first time meeting in person. So I'm so excited because I admire so much what you do, your work. I've literally seen it physically manifested in the city here. And it's just so I think your perspective on your work is so interesting too and so unique. So I'm super excited for our chat today.
Oh, thank you. Same.
So I wanted to talk about, you know, let's start with talking about like what is your overall design philosophy and what's the through line that connects all of your projects and your work together that you would say?
Well, I think, you know, starting off, you know, 14, 15 years ago, there wasn't really any kind of underlying strategy other than it was going to be responsive to the unique qualities of people and places. Mm-hmm. And it was a real reading of the landscape of wherever we were. And in that scenario, it was in Nova Scotia almost entirely. But it was really, I think, meant to be a very clear depiction of what architecture could be in a place. And I think the evolution of that was really kind of in response to the varying types of landscapes and people that we worked with.
Mm. Yeah. And so based off of that, like what do you think defines really beautiful and great design?
Yeah, that's a tough one because I think you know, architects often have very clear ideas about what they think is beautiful, but you know, I think you look around in our cities and you see that there are things that are beloved by different people, right? Different time periods, different materials. I think at the core, it needs to be something that had love poured into it. It needs to have a unique voice. And it needs to be made of quality, not necessarily of expensive materials, but quality of thought and quality of craft.
Yeah, that makes sense. And how do you think, I find the world of design and specifically architectural design such an interesting conversation because it's a medium of which we literally live in and like work in and interact with on a daily basis. So how do you think buildings and structures and facilities really like facilitate meaningful relationships and dialogue between the buildings that we're surrounded with and interact with and live in and work in? How does that act as like a vessel for those conversations?
Well, I think that traditionally it's sort of a one box fits all type scenario, but I actually think architecture is becoming so much more rich in that it's responding to a varying group of people, whether it's people with accessibility requirements or seniors or people with, you know, neurodiverse backgrounds, right? So I think, you know, all of the tools that make a space, whether it's the scale or the way that sound bounces or the way that it makes you feel warm on the inside, I think all of those things vary and really kind of relate to the specifics of people and the program. So, you know, I think a lot of the time it's a beautiful accident as well. You know, I think people like to pretend that everything is planned, but, you know, some of the nicest things we've done were sort of the result of, you know, certain constraints or just timing. And so you just embrace that. You embrace both the things that you plan as well as, you know, those happy accidents.
Right, the serendipitous moments.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I guess when you talk about, you know, how buildings are, you know, designed, erected, maintained, or neglected, what do you think that says about what do you think it says about us, like, as a people and how we value the spaces around us?
Well, I mean, the buildings that we cherish the most, we look after, right? Money gets poured into it, the resources, you know, you look around our cities at, you know, whether it's buildings that are a part of the university campus or historic buildings that people cherish. I think those structures that we are connected to and have, you know, beautiful memories and have nostalgia about, I think ultimately we look after. So when I think we, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about sustainability, but, you know, at its core, beautiful design and things that people love are going to last a long time. In the inverse, you know, the kinds of buildings that sort of just pop up out of nowhere and seemingly have very little thought, I mean, that's just going to be a part of a cycle of, you know, building and tearing down, you know, even in our lifetime.
Yeah, yeah. If we rewind back a few years, what do you think it is that drew you to the world of design and your love for design and architecture in the first place?
Well, I grew up in Brampton, and I went to school, a really beautiful little school in Caledon, Ontario, Mayfield. It's an art school. And so I, you know, that was sort of the first lucky break that I had in my life was being accepted into that school. And then really just falling in love with art and art history and architecture and architectural history and really kind of being exposed to that, I think, without really traveling. So, you know, I didn't see these things firsthand, but, you know, I learned a lot about it. And so, you know, it was really a combination of that. And I think maybe a little bit in the background was the fact that my father, although had nothing to do with that, you know, my mother's a nurse and my father's a lab technician. They're both retired, but you know, that was something that he always thought was really cool. And for some weird reason, when I was a late teenager, I actually listened to my dad and kind of was, you know, open to the idea of going down that road. And I sort of, you know, time just sort of passed, you know, I kind of just stayed on that train. And I feel like I'm actually one of the few people, you know, of all the people I went to school with, that kind of stayed down a path for better or worse.
The path that you went to school for.
Yeah, like I kind of just kept going. And, you know, there were obviously obstacles along the way. But, you know, I think when you go down that road, there are so many other things you can end up branching off and doing. So, I'm really kind of surrounded by people who I think at their core love the arts and architecture, but ended up doing, you know, many, many things.
Right. I mean, that's so true. I feel like a lot of people, I would say the majority of people are not actually practicing what they went to school. I went to school for biochemistry.
Oh, really?
And that was not my destiny. but you know, what's interesting is, you know, you talk about your upbringing and kind of the world that surrounded you. Were there any kind of buildings that were part of like your formative years that really stuck out to you, that kind of helped shape your kind of interest or perspective on what you're doing today?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't grow up, like I said, traveling all that much. And so it was sort of my kind of local environment. And I remember very clearly that the high school that I went to, which was, you know, sort of a mid-century building, probably built in, you know, the early 60s, was just such a like fantastical place. Like I remember the first day of school in sort of the rush of it all getting lost because it was sort of like designed in a bit of a loop. And, you know, obviously that was a bit of a terrifying experience in grade 9, you know, not knowing where I was going. But I ended up just sort of falling in love with all of the intricacies of the space. And so, you know, it wasn't the Pantheon or, you know, any of those things. It was actually just that. And, you know, that hour drive to school, seeing all of the kind of agricultural buildings in the countryside, you know, the kind of romanticism of kind of the local and really simple things, I ended up being really drawn to.
Yeah. And I think your note around like not traveling a lot, but you can still have, you know, a global perspective or a national perspective or whatever it is, or a local perspective without moving, because you're just surrounded by things that are informed by different perspectives as well, right?
Absolutely. And then I think, you know, conversely, at that time, the suburbs were just developing like crazy, right? Mm. And expanding out. And so you were surrounded by this filth that, you know, was sort of in contrast to those beautiful farm buildings and this beautiful school that I went to. You were kind of seeing both at kind of a different scale. And so maybe it was just, you know, really understanding what I didn't like.
Right.
For what, you know, whatever my understanding of that was, but just understanding that these are not things of quality.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that makes total sense. So, you know, a lot of your architectural work often balances like modern aesthetics with a deep respect for the environment and the community that's around it. When do you think you discovered your identity as both an architect and as an artist, and how has that identity evolved over the course of your career?
You know, it evolved, or at least it started as kind of a very light response in a modern way to things that people were familiar with. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I didn't have the context to start building, you know, million-dollar houses at the beginning. It was a little addition at the back or a little cottage on a pretty tight budget. And so I guess working within the constraints of the familiar and forms and materials that can certainly withstand, you know, an extreme climate that we have out there at times. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like you start with the thing that everyone knows how to build, and then there are these really odd sort of moves that are both playful and interesting and maybe exploratory that give it its character. And yeah. So with each of those sort of opportunities, I think that ended up growing more and more. But I've always been really interested in the narrative. And so in our architecture, even at the beginning, it was not very, you know, it wasn't just about kind of this is the building and this is the space. It's about kind of an unraveling of experiences that make you feel a certain way. And so using it as, you know, almost the, you know, carcass of a beautiful story.
Right. You often refer to your projects as creatures that take on characteristics of living organisms and are like a reflection of the ecosystem around it. What are some of your favorite creatures in your stable and what informed their designs?
One of them, I would say, which was built a few years ago, was called the Schlottfeld Residence. It's in the Okanagan, up on sort of a almost burnt out opening on a rocky cliff that looks at the Okanagan Lake. And there's always been this kind of interest in creating things that feel like they've always been there, but not like an old building. It's almost like it's something that grew from the landscape itself. And maybe there are dual kind of personalities to that creature, you know, night and day, winter and summer, depending on kind of the lighting and the way that, you know, the rain hits the wood or whatever it might be. But that was a cool one just in that it really, when you squint your eyes, almost feels like an outcropping in the landscape. And the rusting steel almost feels like a part of that kind of brownish, dark reddish sort of color tones of the rock itself. So that was a wonderful one. Sluice Point was an early one, and that really, you know, again, was meant to mimic almost a little hump in the landscape, you know, a growth that sort of emerged. And, you know, in the evening when the lights are on, it sort of almost feels like it comes to life.
Right. Yeah. No, I love that because you're giving these properties and these buildings like life and like a personality and a perspective and a responsiveness to the ecosystem around them. And it's also being, you know, with the, you talk about kind of the narrative and the perspective, but like how it is an adaptation of
absolutely
the environment around it too, right?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it needs to be resilient. And I think, you know, by thinking of them as creatures or organisms, survival is sort of at the core of it all. And so whether that's about materiality or forms themselves, it needs to not only look like, but actually work in a way that is responding and embracing kind of the unique qualities of that climate.
Yeah, absolutely.
And from, you know, East Coast to West Coast, there's a million different types of, you know, weather systems and landscapes, right? I mean, it varies so dramatically.
I find that so interesting, actually, working with that perspective and that approach and working within Canada, where you have such a, one, huge country,
huge
geographically, and two, you have such a diversity of ecosystems and climate climates, and also with that, the challenges that come with them. You know, we were just talking about the dryness and kind of how cold it is in Alberta, to then you have, an ocean kind of environment for British Columbia.
Yep.
But also, like, specific challenges that come with, like, if you're in the Okanagan, like, planning into the future of, like, wildfires or other things that are issues that are in those specific environments too.
Absolutely. Right? Yeah, and so that Okanagan one, I mean, it's covered in this rusting steel, but ultimately that was partially about fire-resistant materials that can withstand, those sort of, you know, natural sort of disasters that happen on a regular basis. So,
yeah. Very interesting. So from your early experiences to establishing Omergadi Architects, can you share like a pivotal moment or project that really influenced your trajectory as an architect? Like, was there something that was the turning point for you, or has it always been just kind of chipping away at the block?
Yeah, I mean, I think it started quite quickly. I mean, I had three projects over the span of about a year and a half. But before that, I was, you know, for maybe about 6 months or so, because, you know, starting my own practice was really sort of happenstance. I got laid off and I didn't have a job. And so it was, you know, I was doing decks and little washroom renovations and working for, you know, a draftsman for like a couple of months until I had kind of a first break to do a little addition on the back of a house. That kind of quickly became doing, you know, a standalone little home on a tight budget and a slightly bigger one. And that, you know, helped to develop, a language for the way that we approach things. Back then it was just me, so the way I approach things. But it was really, you know, not hesitating. It's sort of, you know, you're responding to each of these unique qualities and you see where it goes. And so I think even now when we take on clients, it needs to be a client that is absolutely comfortable with the unknown, because it's absolutely a journey that is sort of the core of the whole exercise. You know, it's exciting for us to not know where it's going to go. You know, when people say, you know, this is, we like this project, can you do something like that? Or, you know, they like one of our older ones, you know, is there something? Those are, we don't take those on because it just feels like, you know, going through the motions a little bit, right? So, it's just like, I love design. I love architecture. I love other people's design. You know, I think I just get, we get really excited about these things in the office, and we're still a small group. I mean, maybe 12 of us between the two offices. So, but I would say the one that kind of broke us out of houses and into a different scale was the Art Gallery of Nova Scotia, which was an international competition that we won along with an Indigenous team and an amazing team here in Toronto, KPMB Architects. And so that was, it hasn't been built, but that was just, you know, a huge, I think, door into another world. Oftentimes small studios who do kind of small projects end up getting stuck in that world a little bit.
Right. That's really interesting, the relationship that you have with clients and trying to stay fresh or continue challenging yourself, but also challenging your clients too. How do you navigate that discussion where you have a client and trying to encourage them to embrace like a design or an architect's way of thinking so that they're thinking outside of the box and embracing the unknown, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, we have that discussion, you know, and so I think it's getting to know people before you sign on. But I think it's pretty clear when they can look at our work and see that all of our projects are vastly different in terms of the way that we're approaching it, as opposed to kind of rubber stamping something like we have a style or something. So I think most of the time they know that coming in, but you know, it takes a little bit of talking. Usually if people have a clear idea, it comes out quickly, usually in the form of a Pinterest board.
Right.
Yeah.
Right,
so, yeah. You know, that's a little bit of a red flag, but, you know, during the process, I think clients end up falling in love with it a little bit more because it's fun for us, but we want it to be really, really fun for them too.
Of course. Of course. That's really interesting. When you are working with the client, what's the starting point? Are you usually tackling it by starting off or identifying a problem or an inspiration or a feeling or a mood? Where do you usually like to start?
Yeah, it doesn't even start with a sketch usually. I would say that, you know, oftentimes it starts with, you know, a variety of conversations and getting to know people's families. Maybe not directly, but, you know, learning a little bit about, you know, how people live. And I think that was something I realized as a kid, you know, with an Indian background, knowing or realizing at some point that, you know, our customs at home and the way that we eat and the, you know, all these things are very different than, you know, the people I went to school with or lived in the neighborhood with. So, you know, I think that's the first part of it is like, what's the dynamic like? But ultimately, you know, after those first few conversations, we need to be on the site together. We need to kind of understand what drew them to purchasing the property, whether it's an urban or rural site, and seeing, you know, what they fell in love with, right? Whether it's about a view or the way that the sun hits, you know, the site at a particular time of the day, or, you know, something they know about the landscape that we don't know about off, you know, the top of our heads. So.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's unraveling that and then starting with very, very, very crude diagrams or sketches that are not about architecture. They're more about relationships and spatial relationships and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So at no point does it just become architecture. It evolves into that based on all of these kind of data points that we put together.
It's like an exploratory kind of expedition.
Absolutely.
For both parties, I guess.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, as someone that has really raised your profile within the architectural industry, but just in Canada's design community as well, do you think that there is a distinct Canadian architectural identity around these conversations? And how do you see your work contributing to or challenging the idea of that identity?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a modesty. There's certainly ideas about craft and materials. You know, you often see, you know, whether it's a lot of wood or maple or ash or, you know, something repeated because those are things that we're connected to, I think. But, you know, I think that... the other aspect of it is, you know, weather is such a key thing here. You know, you can't hide from it. You need to respond to it. We get, obviously, depending on where you are in this country, vast amount of snow or rain or driving wind or any of those things. And, you know, it's always a bad idea to pretend you're in Miami when you're in Collingwood, for example, right?
I mean, right.
It's just not going to work out properly. Like, architecture needs to respond to those real things. I guess the thing that's really exciting though for me is those things that we've always drawn from, when we talk about we, that's changed so much in the course of, you know, your life and my life. It's like we is not, as Canadians, is a very different group of people, right? Like I think in a community with, you know, predominantly Chinese communities, the things that are important to those people are different. The things that are special to them, the things that make them feel Canadian, I think are very different. And so that's the fun part, is that even at the core, when we talk about our country, that those parameters are completely different than they were when we were kids.
Yeah, yeah, it's such a beautiful thing too, yeah. Right? To be able to take all that into being part of the conversation.
Absolutely.
Right? You know, the East Coast is a recurring theme in your work. How has your East Coast experience influenced your architectural style and the projects that you choose to undertake?
It's been an amazing place, you know, to live. Yeah, I went there for school originally and ended up staying. You know, obviously, you're only driving 10, 15 minutes out of the city and you're in, you know, God's country, right? Mm-hmm. Like the most beautiful landscapes you can imagine. The weather can be extreme, but at the same time, you know, I think when it's raining or, you know, you're getting that driving wind, it can be really beautiful, especially if you're, you know, out on a hike or, you know, in a cottage in a rural landscape. It's pretty amazing. And so I think there's always been a clarity in terms of our studio, the way that we think, and just the ability to think clearly without, you know, enormous amounts of noise around you, mm-hmm. Whether that's actual noise or just influences from things. It's just like, the studio over there, I just feel like I can concentrate, and it's just amazing.
It's like a catharsis.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Singular focus, I guess.
Yeah, and, you know, I think it's a place where people are not flaunting their wealth, and money can go maybe a little bit further, and the landscapes are insanely beautiful, mm-hmm. and there really is an importance when considering climate and landscape as well. So it's just, yeah, you know, it's different. It's different than over here. It's different than in Vancouver, I think. It's just, yeah, it's a beautiful place that is definitely at the core of, you know, my progression as an architect, for sure.
Yeah. And you also have a studio here in Toronto, which is a very different urban setting. You know, Toronto has a very dynamic and diverse architectural scene. How has your experience working in this city influenced your design approach? And then I guess also with that in mind, the marriage and the contrast between the two locations that your studios are located in.
Yeah, and people, I remember when I opened the studio here in 2015, I think, you know, part of the reason for that was that I wanted to be closer to my family, my parents, and you know, Halifax and Nova Scotia, as beautiful as it is, and the kind of success we had early on, it, you know, there's a limit to that, mm-hmm. right? And so we need to sort of branch out. And I think over here, what I told people when they asked those questions about how it was going to impact our work, I just said, it's exactly the same. The answer is very different, but the approach is the same, in that instead of learning and reading landscapes, more often than not, it's about kind of understanding neighborhoods, mm-hmm. Or even parts of neighborhoods, you know, in Parkdale or, you know, Koreatown or wherever it is. It's about kind of understanding what makes a place different and special, and kind of pulling from that to create something that feels like it's part of the fabric. And I've often kind of referred to our projects as this, as being a part of a family, but being the weird kid in the family. So like, it's connected, no doubt, but it's got a character of its own.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. When we talk about architecture and design, how do you think that these two things can be used as a force for positive social impact in our communities?
Well, you know, architects hold a lot of power. You know, in terms of relationships, in terms of, you know, the ability to kind of get projects moving. In our own city, in Halifax, you know, we've been able to completely rejuvenate, you know, historic dilapidated buildings and house the homeless. You know, working with amazing kind of community groups, we've been able to kind of raise money, and I think even just get other people kind of connected and excited, maybe because we're architects, but maybe also because we've been fortunate that people, you know, are often kind of excited about what we're doing. And so there's maybe a little bit of a hunger to be a part of that in mm-hmm. some way. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's a major thing, but it's also a reflection, much like art, of the way that people think in a time. And, you know, I think the importance of sustainability, the importance of, you know, responsible building, I think more than ever, really thinking about adaptive reuse of existing buildings, especially as our cities have changed so much, you know, following COVID. It's a weird thing where people don't go to offices anymore, but we have an enormous population of homeless people in the city. Mm. It's sort of like, well, one absolutely feeds the other. And you see that happening now where, you know, previous office buildings are now turned into residential buildings. So
yeah,
that's really exciting.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, I think we sort of think of it as, you know, the importance for us is to, with each little project, hopefully get people a little bit more excited about architecture, but also the importance of architecture in their own lives and in their community, because that snowballs. You know, it's such a small percentage of quality buildings that are built, you know, on an annual basis versus the ones that just kind of pop up and, you know, as we were saying earlier, like kind of, you know, mindless in a way, you know, just buildings
yep.
that just are there. And so I think through education and, you know, an excitement about buildings and the importance of it, I think, you know, we can change that narrative a little bit in the same way that people think differently about that in other places.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's so interesting because your line of work again, because it's literally something that people are living in, engaging with every day, yeah. working in. It is literally a part of people's everyday experiences, you know, when you're walking down a street or
yep.
or going to your favorite cafe or whatever it is. And this idea of shelter, not necessarily just in like the most kind of, you know, straightforward way in terms of like having something over your head, but this idea of like shelter from like a community standpoint
Absolutely.
Or shelter from, you know, a place to call like a sanctuary or a place to, you know, or something to challenge a sanctuary too.
Yeah.
So with all that being said, like a lot of your projects really exhibit this strong sense of community and engagement. How do you approach designing spaces that foster really the sense of like belonging and community, and what role do local communities play into your design?
Yeah, I mean, with the Art Gallery of Nova Scotia, that was sort of the first, you know, major kind of example of how community engagement, and by including voices that are, you know, typically not a part of the process, can help shape a building, right? And so as a result of that, not only was it, you know, really unique and beautiful, it ended up being beloved by people who were a part of the process. And so, you know, it's pretty amazing when you include the voices of all of these stakeholders and people who I think are typically unheard of in that process. It's like, well, you know, people feel like that's part of them. Right? I mean, you know, that's really special. You know, Peggy's Cove for us was another project where, you know, we built an accessible boardwalk and look off that cantilevers off towards the ocean. And, you know, for months following that, we heard from people who grew up never really being able to navigate that landscape before. And so all of a sudden it was this special thing that has existed for, you know, hundreds of years that's been there, but you know, it was too difficult for them to navigate. And so,
yeah.
you know, I think that's it. And that came from consulting with people who wanted to be heard.
Yeah.
I think that yeah. there's like a shyness, in particular with architects and artists, when talking to too many people, because that's going to impact, you know, where you end up going with it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the exciting part, is like all of a sudden there are all of these other voices and, you know, ingredients that help take you in a direction that you never would have gone down before.
Well, and it's also like a diversity of perspectives helps you tackle a diversity of problems that you didn't even necessarily even realize were things to even consider, right?
Absolutely.
And that then plays into accessibility, inclusivity, and then really engaging the direct community that's going to actually be living in and engaging in that project afterwards.
Exactly.
Once you're finished.
I mean, it's not just about being cool and beautiful. It needs to be something that people love. People love things that make their life better, right?
What part of your perspective, or I'll rephrase, where does like optimism and pragmatism kind of play into your perspective when you're approaching your projects, you know, functional versus form versus, you know, a sense of optimism or cynicism too, like that could be a part of it as well.
Yeah, you know, I think the architect as, you know, typically the leader of the project in a lot of cases, at least from the perspective of design, you need to be optimistic. You need to think that you're building and you're kind of collective idea with your team and all of the kind of people that are involved is going to make the world better, right? And you know, maybe even better than that would be, not only is it making the world better and bringing some joy to people's lives or making their lives easier, it's going to start a chain reaction of events where all of a sudden the things that follow that might learn something from it. So you know, we don't know where it's going to go, but that's like, you know, you dream of that sort of thing where it's going to, even in a small way, make the way that we think about the built environment more productive and, you know, better for the community.
Earlier we were talking about, you know, the exchange that you have with your clients and what that experience is like. Do you think that the business community places enough emphasis on the importance of a great design experience? Like, do you find that that is a part of their initial thinking, or is it more of like an afterthought, or do they place enough weight on it as well?
I think that, you know, I think in most cases, if it's going to benefit the investment, it's probably, you know, then it's something to consider, you know, just in my experience, at least anyways. So, you know, if investing in the design of a building is going to mean higher rent or people are going to be happy with the end result or whatever, but in the end, it's going to be really positive news for that business, I think then it happens. But ultimately, you don't see that happen often enough because people can justify getting away with less. I also don't think that good design needs to be the most expensive design. You know, maybe part of that's education. I don't know, but
an expensive design can also be bad design
too.
It
can absolutely be bad design. Absolutely. Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know. I don't have an answer for that other than to say that I just don't know that people understand the power of good space, you know, and what that can do for a business or, you know, for a culture.
What kind of cues do you think non-designers and non-architects can take from your community, the design community, when it comes to identifying and solving problems?
Can you repeat that one?
How can people who are not in your industry
approach
problem solving through the lens of an architect or a designer?
With the design of a space, you mean, or just in their own world?
Yeah, in their own world. If I am an entrepreneur that is trying to think about tackling a problem, what's like an approach that you would see in through the lens of an architect or a designer that I can apply to my life that would not necessarily be the first thing I think about?
For sure. I think, obviously, for one, architecture and architects are so broad that I can't speak for everybody, but, you know, in terms of my own practice and the way that, you know, that's evolved for us, I think it's about being malleable a little bit. allowing yourself to kind of go down roads you didn't think you would go down, whether it's about tackling a design problem or a business problem or whatever the case might be. I think that there are plenty of opportunities that aren't necessarily in a straight line. The other thing is also understanding what you're good at and when to hire professionals.
Yes, definitely.
You know, I love telling people this story that, like, if there's one thing that I love but know absolutely nothing about, it's wine.
Right.
So I don't even pretend. There's actually like a bit of a joy in dumbing down my own knowledge of wine. I like going to like a wine store and just figuring out who the person is and just letting them take me for a ride.
On,
you know,
a dirty,
like,
yeah.
Just like, you tell me based on this very little bit of information, yeah, what is going to be amazing and what I'm going to love.
Yeah.
It's like no pressure, but like I'm good at only at one thing. Right? Like, I'm not good at
everything.
It takes a lifetime to be good at anything, right? So, you know, it's exciting to kind of allow experts. You know, we just hired an amazing photographer out of Vancouver to shoot these lights we just designed. And I didn't even go in the room once in 3 days to see what he was doing, because I just know that he's the best there is. An absolute like genius artist, and that in my own kind of need for excitement, I just want to be blown away. Like, I just like, show me something, a perspective of looking at something that we never considered.
Yeah, and that's the diversity of perspectives and everything,
yeah,
that we were talking about.
It's so fun.
Yeah,
it's so fun.
Yeah. Just kind of as we round out here, you know, architects often leave a lasting legacy through their work, literally shaping skylines and communities. What impact do you hope your designs will have on the, you know, the architectural landscape, and what kind of legacy are you building for yourself?
Well, I guess, you know, still sort of early in that process, but you know, we've done so many different things at different scales, whether it's, you know, a library that we're working on in Edmonton right now, mm-hmm, in Riverbend, or, you know, art gallery that we've designed, or, you know, lighting or furniture that we've worked on. You know, I'm not sure about the legacy part. All I know is that we're obsessed with design, mm-hmm, and we are kind of in it for almost selfishly for the fun of it all. And it's such a high on a daily basis to kind of be going down roads, like almost like scratching the itch of whatever we want to tackle.
Mm-hmm. And having fun along the way.
Having fun along the way, but at the same time, with each year, through a lot of that process, we're able to contribute, you know, almost in a different sphere in community work. And so we're doing several projects right now in Nova Scotia for the Indigenous community, mm-hmm, a birthing center, as well as housing for Mi'kmaq women in Nova Scotia. And so, you know, we take what we learn from the process of kind of working on the variety of things we're doing, but, you know, we're always sort of tackling things. You know, I didn't come from a place, you know, I had everything I ever needed and wanted growing up, but, you know, I didn't know an architect or knew anyone who didn't live in, you know, a suburban house or something.
Right.
Ultimately, I really need and want to do things for people like my parents, that, you know, community projects that really impact kind of just the people that surround, you know, or people where I came from. So, not that necessarily specifically where I came from, but just things that touch the most people. And
yeah,
so we've kind of been able to do a few of those things now in Nova Scotia, but that really kind of feels amazing.
I love that. Love that.
Yeah.
Last two questions here. We usually round out our interviews by talking about mission and purpose. So what is, and we've kind of spoken about this too, but mm-hmm, if you could kind of summarize it into your own personal elevator pitch to yourself, what would be your mission at the end of the day?
I think my mission is to just keep on pushing and to never be comfortable. Hmm. Artists, architects, you know, whether it's musicians, I think find these niches that they find some success in, and it takes a lot of courage to, I think, just kind of flip the script and go down other roads. And you see that quite often. I think for me in particular, with each time we do it, regardless of the kind of feedback you get at the end of each of those things, it's the process that's exciting. And so I hope that never ends.
Yeah, yeah. Last question, what does glory mean to you?
Glory means going through the journey and not selling out.
I love that. Thanks so much for the chat, Omar. I really enjoyed it, man. And it was so great.
Thank you.
Being able to chat, meet for, you know, the first time, and absolutely. I've been such a fan of your work, so I really, really appreciate the time and the insights.
Thank you, and you got to come out to the East Coast.
I would love to. I have so many good friends that are from there,
that's
so
great.
I'm ready for you.
Oh, awesome. Thank you.
Thanks so much. If you enjoyed this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you left a review on Apple Podcasts. Let us know what you liked, who you'd like to see on the show, and anything else you want to share. To keep up to date, subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen to your podcast. Until next time, ask yourself, what's your mission?